Hello and welcome to this episode of In Conversation With by Kangaroo Mind. I'm Vedika and today we have with us psychotherapist Marcia Ramsu. Marcia is also a counselor and has a relational and compassionate-based approach to therapy. She primarily works within relationship settings with couples, focusing on crisis situations, identity issues, sexuality, and self-esteem concerns. Other than this, she's also very compassionate about working with refugees and asylum seekers. More recently, she had an 18-month time with the Refugee Council in UK where she worked with asylum seekers. Our conversation today is going to center around the topic of mental health within the humanitarian crisis. Within this context, we're going to look at especially refugees and asylum seekers and the mental health concerns that they face. However, before we begin our conversation today, we'd like to put out a trigger warning for our audiences. If at any point during this conversation, should you find yourself feeling triggered or distressed, we urge you to take a step back and look after yourself. Should you need any additional support resources, you can also find them on our website. And now, without taking up much time, let's hear more from Marcia. Marcia, welcome to the episode. It's an absolute pleasure to have you. Thank you for accepting our invitation and joining us.
Thank you, Vedika. I'm really honored to be invited.
I'm really looking forward to, you know, the insights that you're going to bring into this conversation, especially given, you know, not just your interest in working with refugees, but also your recent experience. So at the outset, I think I'm going to ask you that, you know, why do you think it's important that we talk about mental health for those people who have been affected by a humanitarian crisis?
We're talking more and more about mental health in our society, and that is important because we are concerned with what people's experiences of life are, and we are taking seriously times when they are distressed with life. And if we want to be a compassionate society, we need to do that, and we need to extend that compassion to refugees and asylum seekers as well. So rather than just seeing them as numbers, we need to see them as human beings. Asylum seekers and refugees have almost always been through extremely distressing experiences, and they don't have very good mental health. Worldwide, about 31% of refugees have PTSD, being post-traumatic stress disorder, and about 31% have depression as well. That's way higher than it is in the general population. But if you look at the UK and you look at asylum seekers in the UK, and I'll explain the difference between asylum seekers and refugees in a little bit. If you look at asylum seekers in the UK, their mental health is just terrible. So a very high percentage of them have anxiety and depression, and a very high percentage of them have PTSD. And finally, I think it's important to talk about this because the policies that we adopt towards asylum seekers and towards refugees can have a very significant impact on their mental health.
I think, you know, one thing that, you know, as you mentioned, is about the whole care aspect, and I'm going to come to that later in the conversation. But, you know, you mentioned the term refugee as well as asylum seeker, and very often we mix up these two terms and we don't get the nuances of the concepts. So can you throw a little bit more light on the distinction between the two concepts?
Yeah, and so a refugee is someone who has permission to remain in the UK because they're fleeing from danger in the country they've come from. And an asylum seeker is someone who's seeking permission to remain here. Some people are given permission to stay straight away, or they're given it in their home countries, they're part of some kind of resettlement scheme. For example, some people from Afghanistan are going to be given that status automatically. The vast majority of people that come here have to apply for refugee status, and before they have that refugee status, they're called asylum seekers, and that process of applying for refugee status is really brutal.
Okay. So, you know, what are some mental health concerns, you know, that refugees as well as asylum seekers face, both in the long and short term?
So asylum seekers and refugees have lost a great deal. They've lost their homes, their relationships, their professions. They've lost all the things that give people a sense of identity. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about one client who said to me that she didn't know which way was up and which way was down anymore, but also she didn't know who she was anymore. There's an issue of isolation when people come here without knowing anybody, mm-hmm. Without speaking the language the vast majority of the time. Mm-hmm. People are often very traumatized as well, and have post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms, which include things like flashbacks, sense of disassociation. People can be very depressed. There's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen for most people when they come here as an asylum. For everybody, when they come here as an asylum seeker, and they may be returned to their home country that they've fled because they're in danger. That creates enormous amount of stress. And the outcome of this is that people suffer tremendously. People are very depressed, anxious, people make suicide attempts, people are very unmotivated to be able to do all the things that are necessary to establish a life here.
You know, in terms of these difficulties that you outlined, which they face, how do you think that impacts their overall lives, like, you know, in the short and long term?
As I just touched on, establishing a new life in a place, firstly, through going through this brutal asylum system, and then settling into a new place requires enormous amounts of motivation and wherewithal. And if you're absolutely overwhelmed by trauma, or you're very depressed or suffering from terrible anxiety, it's really difficult to take those many, many steps that you need. In order to do that, for example, you need to get a solicitor, you need to make sure the solicitor's kind of fighting for you, you need to learn English, you need to register with a GP. These things are really, really difficult. These things are really difficult for anyone, actually. But if you're suffering enormously psychologically, they're really, really difficult. Mm-hmm. If you have got post-traumatic stress disorder, your thinking often isn't very clear. And when you have an asylum interview, you're asked about what has happened to you and why you've come here and why you feel that you need to have asylum here. And it's difficult for people to provide a coherent account when they're suffering from PTSD, and that increases the likelihood that people are going to be seen as making their story up because they can't provide a coherent account. Then I work with a lot of women who were seeking asylum, and they often had children, and people that are suffering psychologically find it very difficult to be steady and just find the inner resources, the tremendous inner resources that you need to be a good parent. And that means that trauma can be passed down the generation. And there's been quite a lot of research with this, with Holocaust survivors. This can be passed down to people's children, even to people's grandchildren.
I think, you know, one of the things that you've emphasized a lot on is that the asylum process for refugees is absolutely brutal. But this is something which most people don't understand. There's this misconception or this belief almost that, you know, when somebody leaves their country and comes to another country, things are automatically going to get better for them. Mm-hmm. So can you throw a little bit of more light, you know, in terms of what are the realities and some of the challenges, especially in terms of the process for a refugee when they arrive into a new country?
Yeah. So when someone comes and they apply for asylum, assuming they know that they do need to apply for asylum, then they are given some government support, which is some housing and a very small amount of money to live on. Mm-hmm. The housing is often substandard. I had clients that were in tiny, tiny little rooms in vermin infested properties. The move now is to house people in institutional properties. For example, people are being housed in old army barracks in Folkestone, and the conditions there are absolutely filthy and disgusting. People, I've just forgotten the amount that people are given a week, but I think it's something like £5.60 to live on. From that, you need to buy food, you need to pay for transport, you need to buy tampons, you need to be able to buy clothes, you need to be able to afford a phone. There's no televisions in, televisions are not allowed in asylum seekers accommodation. There's no Wi-Fi. On £5.60, you can't really afford mobile data, so people are completely isolated. Then they have to wait for their asylum interview. That can take ages, it can take months or even years. And then once you've had the asylum interview, there can be a really, really long wait again to get a result. The asylum interview itself is, it's adversarial, which means that you are basically seen as lying unless you can prove otherwise. So you are cross-examined, and you're cross-examined about experiences which are super, super traumatic. So this re-traumatizes people. Anyway, then they have their wait. Then only a third of people are given, are believed, and are given refugee status. And often that's on the most ridiculous, flimsy grounds. And then you can appeal to cash evidence, which is sometimes quite difficult to do. Once you're refused asylum, your government comes to an end, which means that you're destitute. You can't stay in your government accommodation unless you're in the process of appealing, unless you've been given the right to appeal. But otherwise, this can take some time to find a solicitor that's willing to appeal, help you appeal. So then you're destitute, you haven't got accommodation, you haven't got any government support, you're not allowed to work, you're reliant on charity support. There are various schemes which help people, like there's a charity called Refugees for Homes or Refugees at Home, where people house refugees, but people often, asylum seekers, but people often don't want to have people staying with them for months at a time. So maybe they'll have them for a week or two. So this means people are moving around continually. Then when people, if people are then able to appeal and they are granted status, even then it's really, really difficult, because you can't obviously just jump from being in asylum accommodation to suddenly having a job and a house and everything. So then you need to apply for benefits. You're initial support is immediately cut off when you get refugee status, and then it's kind of difficult to get benefits straight away. So people are often in a really, really difficult interim stage afterwards.
I think, see, this is something which, you know, people don't throw enough light on, that it's just hard. Like, you know, it's not just that they've struggled while they were in their home country, but also the entire process.
Sorry, can I just add something? I think I didn't say that people are not allowed to work when they're in the asylum process, which is why they are totally reliant on government support. People want to work, but they're not allowed to.
So, you know, just to add to all of this, like, you know, when it comes to them seeking help for their mental health, what do you think some of the challenges and barriers are for them?
Well, the very fact of them having poor mental health, of course, makes it difficult to have the wherewithal to seek help with it. But also, services for asylum seekers are very poorly funded. At the charity that I was working at, the refugee part of the charity was reasonably well funded, and there were lots of supports. There was a lot of support for refugees. Asylum seekers, much, much less, because it's just, I think it must be because it's very difficult to get sort of government and charitable donations to be able to help them, because asylum seekers have got such a bad press. So services are very underfunded. GPs often don't have an awareness of what the issues are facing asylum seekers, and can be sometimes, I mean, obviously it's great ones, but sometimes they can be dismissive. And there's this big language barrier, which is another significant issue. So people are reliant on interpreting services, which obviously completely changes the dynamic of, if you're doing therapy, of a therapy session. Mostly you're reliant on telephone interpreters. Sometimes there's a long wait to get on the line with a telephone interpreter. Sometimes the connection gets lost, so you're halfway through, the client can be halfway through saying something huge, and then the interpreter just goes offline. So sometimes the interpreters are not that great either, or they're not necessarily specialized in dealing with mental health, as opposed to being general interpreters. Also, the women that I dealt with, the women that I was working with at the Refugee Council, they often had children. That's another thing, because there's a question about what to do with children when women are in therapy sessions. A lot of therapists don't want to do sessions with children there, and even if the therapist is willing to be flexible and allow the children to be there, that means that the woman can't speak freely about a rape, or about just how overwhelmed she's feeling. So that's the problem.
I think, you know, in your experience with working with especially asylum seekers, as well as within the Refugee Council, like, what were some of the challenges that you personally faced, and what was your entire experience like?
I think one of the challenges is that without people having their practical needs dealt with, the things that lie at the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, so their need for food, their need for shelter, their need for safety, it's quite difficult to work at a higher level, to work at a psychological level with people. Now, as a therapist, you have to be quite, and I think all the people I was working with had to be flexible. And we spent some time doing things like, I at least spent time trying to help people get solicitors, because that just seemed really, really important. Mm-hmm. But also dealing with housing concerns, and some of the therapy session would have been spent on the phone to people trying to sort that out.
Right.
Then there's the fact that people are just going through these terrible things at the same time as you working with them. So you can make all the progress you want in a therapy session, but then something awful can happen in someone's life by the therapy session, which can really set you back. And I'm thinking most a dramatic example of this might be someone being refused asylum. The outcome of all this is that it can be difficult to make progress with people, especially I would say with asylum seekers, and that can lead to the feelings of burnout, which I don't think necessarily come from having too high a workload, but I think they come from feeling that I think what makes you feel good about work is feeling a sense of efficacy, and it can be quite difficult to feel a sense of efficacy when so much is against you.
Right.
And another thing that I didn't really experience, because I think because of the particular client group I was working with and the extent to which they did or didn't talk about their trauma, but for other people that I was working with, people can get really horrible vicarious trauma just from hearing these just horrific stories. And we talked a lot about self-care, but sometimes it's difficult to do that.
Right. I think, you know, you mentioned like trauma, and of course you brought in the aspect of vicarious trauma as a therapist, but also on the other hand, like what role do you think, you know, like trauma-informed care plays when you are working with this particular group of people?
It plays a huge role because most people are traumatized. So there's a lot to say about this. I could talk for a really long time about it, and you could do a very, very long course about this. But when people are in threatening situations, the lower part of their brain is the bit that kind of takes over, and that lower part of the brain is the bit that protects you against threats. The higher part of the brain, the bit that is kind of the more cognitive part, the bit that's sort of responsible for thinking, for having a sense of perspective, for being able to tune into other people, all of that, that bit of your brain just completely shuts down and the lower bit kind of takes over. So if you are in a threatening situation and you're able to respond to that threat by running away or by fighting back or something like that, then your body and your brain just sort of right themselves and you're usually okay afterwards. However, if you are not able to deal with a threat because you're pinned down or you're powerless, your brain keeps thinking that you're under threat, and that lower part of the brain is still the bit that's active. Like, it means that they can sort of lose a sense of fun, they can be dissociated, they can find it difficult to connect with people, and they're constantly feeling threatened. So therapy conventionally is about helping people gain insight into their symptoms. The idea is that if you understand where something is coming from, then you can respond in a different way and you can start to heal. But if the higher part of your brain is shut down, it's not going to be very useful to help people just understand that the symptoms that they're having is coming from the fact that they've been repeatedly raped or they've seen people murdered in front of them. So you need to work in a different way, and there's loads and loads of stuff about how you work in that different way, but it's just going to be less cognitive. It's going to be more embodied. It's going to be more about helping people feel safe in the room. It's going to be about helping people gradually become better able to tolerate some of the feelings they have when something reminds them of the traumatic situation that they're in. So firstly, you help people feel safe. That can be helping them with breathing exercises. It can be helping them feel grounded. It can be telling them to walk around the room, go and sit in a part of the room where they feel particularly safe. And then it's kind of just gradually and gently getting them used to tolerating difficult feelings and being conscious of the sort of ebb and flow of those difficult feelings, like the way that they maybe come in a part of your body and then they pass away, or if you think about something else, they pass away. There are various techniques you can use to help people. There are techniques that are often not used by therapists as well, like I wouldn't be able to do this, but there's massage therapy, which can be helpful for people. There are just things like yoga and Tai Chi, kind of embodied things, which are useful for people. And the other thing though that I think is quite important with trauma is about helping people reconnect with people, because that gets lost when people get traumatized. And the first thing that people do when they're in danger is to turn to other people for support. And then if no one else can support them, then the other responses kick in. So if you can get people connected, then that can be really, really healing. So I think groups are really helpful for people. Yeah. And sometimes doing embodied things in groups, like dancing, singing, acting, I don't know, doing martial arts, all of that. So it's a really, really long answer, and I could talk for much longer about that, but I'll stop there.
No, I think there's so many aspects, right? When it comes to helping refugees, it's not, and asylum seekers, it's not just about understanding that, okay, you know, so-and-so is having a mental health issue, but it's also about getting them a sense of community, helping them cope with that sense of trauma, dealing with flashbacks, coping with almost grief as well in a large sense, isn't it? But
yeah.
But one thing that, you know, in terms of what you mentioned, is that in the process of moving, they've sort of lost a sense of identity. So where do you think that whole aspect of having a cultural understanding of these people can help you in, you know, helping them look after their mental health?
I think we need to be quite mindful that the models of therapy that we have are quite often Western centric. They're often about individual experience, divorced from context. And a lot of the questions that we might ask are, well, what did you think of that? Or how does that make you feel? And for some people from different cultures, that kind of question can be quite alien and not just not very helpful. So an example might be, instead of saying to somebody, how did you feel about that situation, it might be just saying, well, what can you do about that situation? Okay. We also need to be quite conscious that people express psychological distress in different ways in different cultures. So it can, in some cultures, psychological distress can be expressed more through physical symptoms, and we need to be attuned to that and aware that those physical symptoms can be a sign of someone suffering quite a lot psychologically. We also need to be really careful not to pathologize people's suffering. People suffering as well. So to understand that these symptoms come from a particular context and particular experiences that people have had, rather than them being some inner psychological disturbance.
You know, to sort of tie in all the things that we spoke about today, like, how do you think, you know, then we can actually work towards improving the mental health of refugees and asylum seekers?
Yeah, so I think that's about not just looking at mental health, but it's about looking at the environments that asylum seekers live in, and about bit having, firstly, it's about having a much, much more compassionate view of asylum seekers, mm-hmm. not having this horrible language about them, you know, like illegal asylum seekers often is kind of tied together with illegal asylum seekers, for example. And these are human beings that have suffered tremendously and are suffering at our hands. And mm-hmm. what we should be trying to stop them suffering so much at our hands. And there are various ways that we can do that. So I think if we have a more compassionate view, we'll give resources a little bit better, so we can improve the conditions that people are living in, improve their accommodation a bit, not put people in this horrible institutional accommodation. We should get rid of the, actually I don't think I mentioned this when you asked me about what it was like for asylum seekers when they came here, but I think I forgot to mention that asylum seekers, before they're given the right to remain, they have to go and report their presence to the Home Office regularly, every 2 weeks or so. And when that happens, they can be detained, imprisoned, which is really terrible. We need to get rid of the threat of that. We should be allowing asylum seekers to work as they are allowed to in other countries. And there is a movement to that. Dominic Raab only said this week that he's not opposed to the idea of asylum seekers working. If asylum seekers can work, then they're not left alone in their homes, just going over and over their horrible traumatic memories, but they can get a sense of purpose and confidence. Mm-hmm. And it's good for everybody because they're contributing as well. But also we need to speed up the asylum process so that people are not waiting for ages both to have their substantive asylum interview and to get the results of their asylum claim. Their asylum interview also shouldn't be adversarial. It shouldn't be guilty until proven otherwise. It should be, we've got this person, we're going to just try and find out what's happened so we can make a fair decision and so we're not re-traumatizing people.
So Reena, that's been a very informative and enriching session. I think you've touched upon so many aspects about, you know, what refugees and asylum seekers go through and, you know, why it's important to have these conversations. Because when we talk about mental health and we talk about inequalities, I think this is such a huge aspect of inequality, you know, that human beings are struggling and human beings are suffering in this way, and there are so many things that we can do about it. So thank you so much for joining us and, you know, sharing all your insights and giving us your time. And I'm sure a lot of people who are going to watch this are going to find it very informative, because it comes from a very different perspective than what we typically think of when we think of, you know, refugees and asylum seekers and what they go through once they've left, you know, their home country.
Yeah, I'm really happy that I can contribute to the debate in a small way. You know, if just a few people watch this and think a little bit about what it's like for asylum seekers and talk to people and change a few people's attitudes, that would just be fantastic. So thank you very much for inviting me.
No, thank you so much. And lastly, for anyone who's watching this today, if you have any questions, please let us know down in the comments and we'll try and come back and address them. And at the end, I would just like to say to anyone who's watching this, like, if you're having a hard time with your mental health right now, just know that, you know, it gets better. There's help out there. And if you see anyone else like who's struggling and if you are concerned about them, please have that conversation. It can go a really long way. So till next time, please stay well and stay healthy. Thank you.